Hello, this is Barbara Van Dalen. Thank you for joining me today on Inner Space. Inner Space is a special program that helps us pay attention to our own emotional health and well-being and the health and well-being of those we love. Today on Inner Space, we're going to explore the mental health issues that affect those who serve in the military, our veterans, and the people who love them. You're in for a treat because we're starting off with pieces of a speech by former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, who joined us at an event in London last fall. Following Joe Biden's speech, I had a chance to sit down with Minister Tobias Elwood. He is the UK Minister of Defense.
We had to examine over 200 bodies to try and find my brother. And that's the piece that I've had to come to terms with, that difficulty then, and then going through the process of repatriating of the body.
And following that, I'm going to chat with Pam Swan from Veterans United, whose work supports our veterans here at home. All three of these individuals share a desire to remove the barriers that prevent our service members and our veterans from seeking the care and the support that they deserve. Former Vice President Joe Biden has always been a powerful advocate for those who serve in their families, as well as for those who experience mental health challenges. We were so fortunate to have the Vice President as a speaker at Givenauer's second global summit on mental health culture change in London last fall. Vice President Biden spoke eloquently, earnestly, and passionately about our military heroes and the many extraordinary service members, veterans, and military families he met during his time in office. He also shares stories that they shared with him, stories that can help all of us break our silence about emotional pain. Finally, Vice President Biden told us the story of the promise that he and his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, made to their son, Beau, who served in the National Guard. They made that promise right before Beau died of brain cancer.
And I'd like to start by telling the story. There was a young man, combat veteran from Afghanistan. His name was Jason Kander. And Jason Kander is a very talented young man. He ran for the seat for the United States Senate 2 years ago in the state of Missouri, which is in the middle of our country. And in a close race, he lost, but he has a great devotion to public service. And he announced to become the mayor of Kansas City, one of the largest cities in Missouri. And it was, most people thought, well on his way to obtaining a victory. Last week, he took a very serious step. He dropped out of the mayoral race to get help for post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. And he did so in a very, very public way, in large part to give courage to many of his colleagues who suffer the same as he had, but are smitten by what they believe the stigma of seeking that kind of help. And he explained in a statement that for a long time, he felt like he hadn't been through enough. He hadn't been tested enough to really qualify for being the victim of post-traumatic stress. Think of that for a minute. He had this post-traumatic stress, but he thought he hadn't suffered enough. Well, how could he claim that that was part of his problem? And he became skilled at putting on a very brave face, even though inside he was wrestling with thoughts of suicide. But he wrote, and I quote, "After 11 years of trying to outrun depression and post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, I finally concluded that it's faster than me, that I had to stop running, turn around, and confront it." Now, as all of you know, Jason is not unique in my country or yours. And this may be the only audience I don't have to explain the breadth and depth of the problem that exists. What Jason did, in my view, was give tens of thousands of the 300,000 returning veterans in my country, we estimate, who are suffering from post-traumatic stress, we have no firm numbers, who are fearful of coming forward, to not be fearful of the stigma if he could stand up and go on national television and say, "I need help. I need help." You all know our warriors are trained to never be afraid, to not have to seek help, to be able to handle those. My dad would say, never complain, never explain. But he did it. His courage is actually more in common than the service so many have provided, and that's significant. And the hope is that it won't take 11 years for people like Jason to step forward. It's what I've been fighting for my entire career. In our administration, we made sure that the Affordable Care Act, for example, for the first time in our history, treated mental health the same as physical health. No distinction, none whatsoever. And it has to be covered, by insurance. And after the massacre, as was referenced, at Sandy Hook, Connecticut, where a young man who was mentally unstable took a gun that his mother actually had, walked into a school and stole the lives of 20 children and one teacher, it became clearer and clearer, not just to me, but to my country, that a significant portion of the violence that exists in my country is a consequence of serious mental health disorders that go unattended, or even when they're observed, aren't reported. One of the things that that became clear to me, and Dr. Mandalan was participated in that and helped us work our way through some of those complex problems. Even before going to the White House, I saw there was a real need for mental health in a whole range of areas that we didn't pay much attention to before. I wrote a law, which I'm very proud of, called the Violence Against Women Act. And when I wrote the law, I was criticized by some for saying that I am confident that women who are repeatedly abused by their husbands, who the dinner's not on the table and smacks their head against the wall and abuses them, are bound to be suffering from post-traumatic stress. No different than a soldier on the front lines, no different at all. And I was rightly criticized for not being able to prove it, but I was certain of it. So the Center for Disease Control in our country came out with a report last year pointing out that women suffer seriously from post-traumatic stress, women who are abused, as well as a number of compromising of their immune system, and they have higher rates of heart disease and a whole range of things that, in fact, finally are coming to the fore. And I remember, as an elected official, how many times parents would come up to me and say, my child needs help. I don't know what to do. There's this problem or there's that problem. And I don't know where to go. And in my country, 8 out of 10 children with mental disorders don't get any treatment at all. When I drafted this Violence Against Women Act, it began to shed broader light on the extent of those who need assistance and need help. And so what happened was my wife and I became convinced that making mental health care affordable and easier to obtain wasn't just the right thing to do. It was overwhelmingly in the interest of society to do it, not just the family and the individual, but in the interest of society that it be done. And the World Economic Forum, which I've spoken at several times, says that the next 2 decades, mental illness will make up more than half of what we spend on fighting all diseases. And better treatment results in a safer and a more secure, humane society, less violence, less crime, less suicide. You know, we talk about gun deaths in my country. You know what the consequence, more people die of a gunshot wound as a consequence of committing suicide in the United States of America than any other single cause, committing suicide. And so the access to mental health services is essential. But making sure people can get the care we need isn't enough, in my view. We need to make sure that people know that the care is available, where to get the care. We need to ensure that they have access to health care providers. In many parts of our country, in rural areas, there are no psychiatric facilities. There are no psychiatrists or even psychologists. How do they get the help? We have to be able to draw essentially a roadmap for people, how to find the assistance that is available. We have to make sure that that we ensure that insurance policies include mental health. This is only now beginning because of the doctor and others being raised as a national issue. And my hope is we can keep the momentum going. We want to make clear to all people that there is no stigma to seeking mental health services. There's more than a few companies in America. If you acknowledge you have a mental health problem, you get fired. You get dismissed, Mr. Minister, if you have a mental health problem from the United States military. on the spot. At least you still have access to veterans assistance and the like. But the most important thing we can do, in my view, is, and this is more anecdotal, but I think it's much broader than most people think, is begin to beat down the barrier, the stigma of seeking mental health assistance. Getting treated for depression shouldn't be any different than getting treated for a broken arm or getting treated for a heart condition. It is a physical condition. Our son, Bo, my son, who was the Attorney General of the state of Delaware and a major in the United States Army, spent the better part of a year in Kosovo in the middle of the war, trying to help them set up a criminal justice system because he was an assistant U.S. attorney and he was there. And then he joined at age 32. He joined the United States military to go serve for a year in Iraq. And he was proud of his service to his nation and proud to wear the uniform. But when he came back, he saw many of the men in his command hurting and the women in his command hurting. He saw that they were wounded, both visible and invisible wounds. And they weren't often reaching out. They didn't know how to reach out. They were afraid to reach out. And he believed that very few thought they could get the help for these invisible wounds, that there was help available, even if there was no stigma attached. So when he came home, before he was diagnosed with cancer, when he came home, he sat with his mother. And this is, I apologize for, as we used to say in the United States Senate, Mr. Speaker, a point of personal privilege. But he came home and his mother was deeply involved in trying to deal with the problems relating to military families. And he asked his mom to give her word that she would focus on mental health. Ever since then, Jill has been on a tireless mission to make things better. In the White House, she made sure that the campaign to change direction was part of her Joining Forces initiative with Michelle to, again, focus on military families. And we made it a key priority in the Biden Foundation, which we set up after we left office. Courage, strength, composure in the face of danger. These are characteristics that make our troops the finest warriors in the history of the world. But they also prove to be barriers to seeking help. As I said, they're trained never to complain. They're trained to view themselves as invincible and fearless, not just for themselves, but for the men and women who depend on them. And too many of them feel if they acknowledge their problem, they're letting down their troops. They're letting down the people who they serve. But they can't let anyone down, and we can't let them down. We have to help them see that getting treatment is the opposite. It's a sign of strength. It's a sign of strength. We have a lot of obligations, and I get criticized for saying this at home for the last 25 years. But in America, and I think in Great Britain, we only have one sacred obligation: to equip those we send to war and care for them and their families when they come home. It's a sacred obligation. It's the only truly sacred obligation that we have, in my view. And that's to properly equip them, but also to care for them when they come home. I think we're making some progress. I think things are getting a little better because of you, and I'm not being solicitous. And you're the people who are going to make this change. You're the people who can do better for our service members, our survivors of violence, our children, and so many people who are dealing with difficulties every single day. You know, I'm awed by the number of people in my country, millions, who get up every single day facing dilemmas much more dire than the ones I faced, with no help like I've had. But every day they get up, they put one foot in front of the other, and they go out, and they march, they provide. So many of them need to know, we know, that maybe they need a little extra help, and it's available. So the main reason I came, beyond Jill telling me I had to, main reason I came was to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is one of those inflection points. Maybe for the first time in history, we'll break the barrier between mental health and physical health and understand it's the same issue. So thank you for what you're doing. God bless you. May God protect our troops.
I want to thank Vice President Biden for honoring us with his words at our summit. It was so important to have him with us for our kickoff event at the Speaker's House in Parliament as we set the stage for the gathering of stakeholders, leaders, and people with lived experience to tackle one of the most important issues of our time, changing the culture of mental health. Among those speakers who joined us is someone who shares the Vice President's passion for supporting those who serve and their families. The Honorable Tobias Elwood, Britain's Minister of Defense, sat down with me in Parliament to discuss our nation's common problems, his experience of being involved in two terror attacks, and about the most important work of his life.
One thing that our two nations share is the professionalism of our armed forces. And in a very changing and challenging world, we need to be able to recruit the best, the brightest, to step forward, particularly with the distractions and opportunities that there are in the civilian street. In order to do that, we need to convince them that they won't just be looked after whilst they serve, but also when they finally pack up their uniform, slide it back across to the quartermaster, that there will be this support for the rest of their lives. They do something quite incredible in serving our nations, and we have a debt of gratitude that must continue for the rest of their lives. And that is the piece that I'm interested in, and it's been fascinating to compare how we do that. And we do that in different ways. Neither is correct or wrong in that sense. Both are correct, but we can learn from each other, and that's been a really exciting journey.
And I would say no one's quite figured out how to do it to ensure that we don't lose service members who come home with challenges. We're trying, I think, both of our nations and many others, but it's complicated, isn't it, caring for those who come home with these invisible injuries.
The challenge has always been to really understand how best that help can be provided. And even when I departed, this whole aspect of mental health wasn't really, or mental illness wasn't really fully understood.
When you served.
Absolutely. And there was certainly a stigma to even putting a hand up to say, I'm suffering from something or I'm having difficulties. Knee injuries, you know, physical injuries, absolutely. You can get them repaired and everybody understands that. Would you dare put your hand up and say, no, I can't handle this? No, it goes against the ethos of what the armed forces was all about.
When you were serving, do you remember seeing men or women that it was clear to either to you or others around you that they were struggling and probably now in hindsight they could have used someone to come up to them and say, I see you're having a hard time? Do you remember people around you?
Not specifically. I think there were occasions where I did question the mental wellness of some individuals, and I didn't have a problem with saying, you know, go and see the doctor, you know, and so forth. But it wasn't a natural thing. It wasn't encouraged. It wasn't something that came down from up on high to say, listen, it's okay to talk about it. The trouble is that the stigma that surrounded mental health then was that if you did admit, it might be you might get labelled, and that would affect your career prospects, you know, promotion, and so forth. And so people kept quiet about it. And the trouble with that is that it could then incubate, it could then compound, it could then get worse, and then you affect your relationship, you know, at home, your ability to do your work, and then you end up leaving the very thing you love, you know, the armed force environment, which also is another stressful factor because you're moving away from that umbrella of security that any armed force environment provides, stepping back into the civilian world, which is you're no longer at home or takes a while to adjust to, and that can also cause challenges as well.
You became world famous in 2017. I remember hearing about you and your actions on the Westminster Bridge long before we met, and that must have been just I can only imagine how powerful that day must have been. Can you talk a little bit about what happened that day in March? It was March, wasn't it?
Well, it's very kind of you to say. The division bell went. So I was actually in another building. I was a minister in the Foreign Office at the time. The division bell goes. A vote was taking place, so I had to move across from the other side of Whitehall, the area here. And I heard a crash. I couldn't see it because there were some barriers. So I actually heard the vehicle that had just mown down a number of people on the bridge.
This was a terrorist attack.
Yes. So I heard it unfold, and I heard the screams, but I couldn't see it. And so I was aware something was happening. And then as I moved across another building, there were screams and shouts, and that's when I heard the shots that were fired and people in panic running away. And like many who have, are fortunate to have the training that we have in the armed forces, not just in dealing with battle conditions, but also in first aid, I then moved forward to the location where it was taking place. And there was must have been 30 officers, all with their guns pointing towards the big gates. And that's where I saw PC Keith Palmer lying on the floor, bleeding heavily, with three other police officers desperately trying to help. But I could tell that, no disrespect to them, but they weren't quite sure what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's when I ran forward and said, I'm a medic. I'm medically trained. Can I help? Mm-hmm. And they said, tell us what to do. And so I did what I could, very sadly, tragically. We weren't able to save him. He'd lost so much blood. Mm-hmm. And this was after medics arrived and then a helicopter arrived as well with doctors on board as well. But my inclination is that no matter what the situation is, whether it be a terrorist attack, whether it be a tsunami, a natural, a man-made disaster, there will always be some that will, through their background, their education, who they are, that will step forward. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so important that we allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to encourage anybody to step in. You have to make that judgment yourself. But I worry that whether it's even just challenging antisocial behavior on a bus or violence with a motorbike gang, you know, when mass steps forward, not just one individual, mm-hmm. but once one does, others will as
follow.
Well.
Mm-hmm.
You actually close down the space of bad. You close down the opportunity for bad people to take advantage of what I worry is society becoming a bit risk averse.
Yes.
And that, I think, is so, so important that we don't lose sight of the power of the community, of us owning it and not giving the space there.
Such a tragedy. Mm. How did that affect you?
I suppose I've not seen anybody because of it. Sadly, I've had other challenges and exposures to things in my past that you, I think, almost become immune to it in that sense. The training absolutely helps, otherwise I wouldn't have done it in the first place. I think the thing that haunts me is the fact that we weren't able to save him. Mm. This wasn't the first time I'd given CPR. Mm-hmm. It was the third time. And I learned from the previous two times that you really do need something to work on. You know, if you turn up to somebody and there's no heartbeat, mm-hmm. There's no breathing, it's really difficult to get mm-hmm. life back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You need something to work on. And when I arrived in front of PC Keith Palmer, he had a pulse, and I could feel it. So I thought, yes, we're going to be okay here.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But the other takeaway is, and I remember this, I was actually, I went through the American Boy Scout system. So I'm actually an Eagle Scout. So I can share that with you. Nobody here in the UK
knows what an Eagle Scout is. Yes, that's amazing.
But again, I did the whole CPR training and things like that. And that's the one thing I've done a lot of, which is to encourage people to learn skills. Mm-hmm. You never know when you might be that individual. We all talk about the first responders. Actually, the first responders to any event is actually the general public.
Yes.
Is the general public. And if you are equipped with the key skill sets, you could provide that extra bit of support until the emergency services arrive. And I've been doing a lot of encouraging that front.
Mm. And you mentioned that this you had before that experienced trauma. And I know that you suffered the loss of your brother as well. So you are not this emotional pain. You have seen it. You have experienced it. And I wonder how that affects your work now when you're trying to develop, create, implement, promote programs to help these men and women, most of whom come home great,
yeah,
but there's a chunk that they're hurting, aren't
yeah.
they? They're struggling.
Yeah. Very sadly, I lost my brother in the Bali bombing in 2002, and there was chaos for a number of days. Nobody knew where my brother was, and so I joined my sister out there, and we had to examine over 200 bodies to try and find my brother. And that's the piece, if I've had to come to terms with that difficulty then, and then going through the process of repatriating of the body. So that was tough, there's no doubt about it. But you do become slightly desensitized, I suppose, in a way. There wasn't the facility to talk to anybody about it in those days. Again, the pressure of just being an army officer, I just have to sort of zip it up and deal with it. Mm. And that's the approach. And I now realize in doing this job that that's exactly the wrong thing mm-hmm. to do. And actually, you should talk to somebody about it. You should have an oasis where you feel able to share. And perhaps that's the key to this, is that many veterans would feel uncomfortable talking to a stranger or talking to somebody. You have to find the right locality where you can let it all out
yes.
and understand it and place it into context. And that is so important.
Do people who know your story, who know these different parts of you, who are maybe either in public service themselves or they've served, do they seek you out? Have you had people come to you to share their own stories when they hear what's happened to you, what you've been through?
It does happen quite frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite interesting because we then share to say, have you sought help? No, we haven't. And it's like, well, by sharing with each other, we are providing a little bit of venting of concerns and, well, how are you doing? And it's almost like a bizarre club that you're mm-hmm. in, that you share something like that. But we need to break away from that. Mm-hmm. And it isn't so much perhaps sharing as well. The other piece of the veteran support is actually simply providing an avenue to say thank you to these people.
Mm-hmm.
It's making them feel continually welcome and appreciated by society. And that's where we're learning from you, mm-hmm. because we see this in abundance in the United States, of the reverence and respect that you show in a very practical manner. And you do it in any airport I go to, and people are in uniform. The gratitude and thanks, which is then complete strangers going to somebody saying, thank you mm-hmm. for your service. We're a bit reticent over here. I don't know what it is. The British Reserve. And we need to learn from you about that.
And it's interesting. We were talking earlier about, first responders. What you just were sharing about people coming to you and the two of you sharing with each other, that is that same first responder notion, that we can all do a better job of saying, I understand, or maybe I don't understand this, but here's what happened to me.
Yeah.
It at least allows people to feel that what they've experienced is of value, it matters, it's received. And I think about, as you said, the British Reserve, and I do feel that sometimes the culture here is almost quick to move away from that receiving, or they may be very warm toward me, but if I'm trying to be warm in return, there's almost a bit of a reluctance to be vulnerable. Is that, do you think that's fair?
I think that's very fair. And that's why the programs that we're introducing in the armed forces to the serving personnel is to say, it's okay to say I'm not okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to share, knowing that if you sort things out on an early basis, you can get back into the front line and it won't be a problem.
Yes.
And if you are able to identify something, it will not spiral out of control into something worse. And that's absolutely important to get that mindset in. And but, of course, there are many people who left the armed forces that will not benefit from this new approach that we brought in, because the strategy not only just involves better education, so helping prevention, but early detection and then treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And you want every soldier, every husband or wife, every friend to be able to say, I'm looking out for you as well. We want that mentality to develop, and it is happening. Every captain of every ship, every platoon commander, every sergeant, to be aware that mental health, mental fitness is all of our responsibilities.
Yes.
And that is taking time to change. But we are seeing, already we're seeing evidence of change. And I think that's an important aspect to make, because every day people are doing that.
Yes.
Up and down the country, in both our countries as well. Good people are standing up for good.
Yes. and challenging,
you know, bad things. They don't get mentioned. They're not in the press. It's not in the public domain as the things that we've spoken about. But they should be acknowledged. And I think that's very, very good indeed.
Yes. Well, thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you very much indeed.
I want to thank Minister Elwood for joining me for this fascinating and inspiring conversation. He believes, like many of us who work in this space, that our veterans, our military families, they need all kinds of things. It's important for us to step up and serve them and give them the help and support they need. Just as Minister Elwood talked about running toward those who are in need, Pam Swan is one of those people. Her work at Veterans United helps us see that there are lots of ways we can support those who serve our country and their families. My friend Pam Swan is an amazing and powerful voice in the veteran space, not just when it comes to finding homes for those who have served and their families, but for the notion that if we don't go beyond providing just a house, we really aren't providing homes for those who serve. This conversation is all about that. An important point that Pam makes during this interview is that a house is just that. It's just the frame. It's just the building. If we don't make sure that the people who live inside that house are functioning well, are being productive members of society, are caring for each other, then we failed.
Talk to me about what you do at Veterans United and what takes you literally all over the country.
Well, thank you for having me here for this podcast. I think it's an amazing opportunity. As you mentioned, I do work for Veterans United. I'm the Director of Military Relations and Business Development. We have a very unique foundation, mm-hmm. and our foundation is called Veterans United Foundation. And as you well know, it's completely employee-funded and employee-ran.
Which, let's just pause for a
yes.
moment, because you know, what's so amazing, there's many things amazing about the foundation. For me, as the head of a nonprofit, years and years ago, when we were, you know, in the throes of doing our work to provide free mental health care to those who serve in their families, I got an email from someone who we both know and love, who was with Veterans United Foundation, who reached out and said, "Hi, I'm with Veterans United Foundation. We have learned about your organization. I'd love to talk to you." And when I learned that it was completely the foundation, completely run and funded by the employees of Veterans United, I'd never heard of such a thing.
I like to say that we're one of a kind.
I think you are.
And then I usually follow it up with, I hope there becomes more like us.
I do too. I
think that we have definitely developed the mold. And I would like to see somebody take it to the next level. And I tell everybody, yes, I work for Veterans United Home Loans, the leading VA lender in the nation. And I am so, so honored to do that. But I don't do my job without talking about our foundation. I think our foundation makes our corporation that much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the fact that when I started, I was employee 700 and something. We're up to 2,400 employees.
Wow.
And the week that I went to check out the company to determine if I wanted to come leave a company I've been with for 15 years and go to a different company, huge challenge for me. And this company kept asking me to come and I knew nothing about it. They were unveiling the first 2-week premises of their foundation.
Huh.
It was brand spanking new.
Huh.
And I fell in love.
Oh.
I thought, how could this small little company of 700 people raise this much money in 2 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
And here I am, 7 years later, we have given close to $50
million
to veterans organizations. We help our community as well. It's not just about our veterans, because we have 98% of our employees are civilians mm-hmm. with no military connection. Mm. And they're giving their hard-earned dollars. But this is employees see what we do, and which is a big part of why I'm affiliated with the foundation, mm-hmm. is how do they see it? When we start working with big national partners, when we start working with Give an Hour,
mm-hmm.
and we have the people like we were talking about before that researches to find organizations out there, to make sure that our employees were meeting their needs of what they want to give to. And doing that, you got to be able to come back and tell the employees a story. You got to be able to show them what their dollars are going to, because we want to motivate them to continue to give.
To give, absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk about a little bit about Pam 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Back then. And your experience with the military and then sort of the broader, because that's the other thing about the military. You know, my dad served, my uncle served, my nephew is currently serving.
Thank you.
And absolutely, and thank you. And what I think people don't often understand is military and veteran families, they are coming sort of in and out, you know, of that world, and they're in, they may have both feet in, they may have one in, they may have family members. Serving in the military, it's challenging.
Yes. Even
peace under peacetime,
yeah. Yes.
People move every 2 years, mm-hmm. They may be deployed separate, you know, away from their family. You may live in a country that the acculturation is challenging, all these things. When you look back and think about sort of how mental health challenges, mental health conditions were responded to, viewed, understood, what do you think about then, and where do you see us now?
I guess my very first comment would be, when anyone mentioned the word mental or illness or mental health, anything that remotely was considered a weakness. Mm-hmm. It was
seen as a weakness,
yes,
right?
Yes. And so it became reality to service members. And even when you saw the service members having the issues and you knew there was something, you kept your mouth shut.
Family members.
Yes. And if you didn't want to jeopardize your husband's career, mm-hmm. and that was always the stigma, is if I say anything, if I show a weakness, I'm going to lose my career. I'm going to get kicked out of the military.
And in the community, you know, of families sharing, talking, because as a mental health professional, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, families would come to me. My office was in McLean, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So I would see families, and their anxiety about this has to stay in,
yes,
here.
Yes, confidential.
And they would talk about the larger community and the challenges and the struggles. So when you saw your friends or other families struggling, that must have been painful at times.
I think back to seeing all the times that I watched neighbors and friends hurt. What if we were the way we are now, where somebody could walk up and have a conversation? I mean, now I'm actually talking to our loan officers at Veterans United about the five signs and
yes.
using those signs to recognize what they might hear over the phone. We get so many clients over the phone that I'll get a call and they'll say, hey, I think this client may have PTS that I'm not able to get
through. Post-traumatic stress,
yes.
For those who may not know.
Yes. And they'll ask me for resources, or who, we just had another one that the wife called because her husband had passed and he had died in combat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the son was suicidal.
Yes.
This is a lady trying to use her VA benefit.
Right. But
and
that ain't the only thing that's going on,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
And now they can come and have these conversations a little, you know, more freely. They can talk to a loan officer and bring it up. But society now is looking at it and saying, this is our duty.
Mm-hmm.
This is our responsibility to each other and to ourselves.
So let me ask you this. So clearly you see, and I see, that we've made progress.
Yes. There's a lot more.
There's a lot more. You know where I'm heading here.
Yeah.
I often think about it kind of like in my head. I think about a patchwork quilt. I'm from rural California.
Yeah.
You know, people made quilts.
But my mother still makes quilts.
All right.
There's a quilt making thing in her building that she lives in.
Which is, by the way, is one of those healthy habits. You know,
yes.
It's like it's an activity. It's community. It can do all these good
things. Keeps her from calling me constantly.
There you go. It's all good.
She'll never watch this podcast. She doesn't know what that means.
So I think about, you know, the work we're doing often, and I refer to it so that people can make sense of what we are doing as those patches.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's a big, humongous quilt we're working on. And there are now patches that I'm feeling pretty good about. But there's a lot of unquilted
right.
space out there. When you think about that, and you know, again, using Veterans United, which I think, in my experience, is a very enlightened organization, but there's a lot of darkness still out there.
Yes.
In our broader community, I'm not differentiating in this sense, the military from the broader, right?
Right.
What do you think, what do you see that is effective, that works, that helps us move this conversation in the military and veteran space?
I think other veterans that have experienced a positive impact in their lives is, and I hate to give this analogy, but it's like the diet that works.
Huh, interesting.
That everybody wants to share. And so finding where it has worked and impacted, those ambassadors have to be so loud and so visible to other veterans. And we have a lot of ambassadors out there, mm-hmm. but this is taking a different step than just an ambassador mm-hmm. saying, yeah, it works. I mean, it's giving examples. It's sharing the hard things that have happened.
And, to them.
Yes.
And what they found, right?
Yes. The other thing, I don't want to miss telling you this, that with our large donations that we do at Veterans United Foundation, we query on a survey all of our employees throughout the year to ask them what means the most to them.
Yes.
Where do they want their
money?
Yes.
Yeah.
And resounding the last 2 years, the highest percentage single thing that they want to do is help the mental health of our veterans. What's making them say, that's the biggest concern for me right now? Well, I have to think that the majority of them are hearing on the other end of the phones with our clients and talking to them and hearing their mental health issues because people are coming out and talking about it.
Yes.
I mean, they might be talking to somebody in post-closing. They've already done their loan. And we train our employees to listen to their clients.
Mm-hmm.
Listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what I would ask all of America to do is listen.
I want to thank my friend Pam Swan for joining us today to talk about these important issues affecting those who serve and their families. Pam is an amazing example of someone who always goes above and beyond. She's inspiring and she's effective. Thank you so much for spending your time with us today. Remember to pay attention to your inner space and make sure you check in with the people you love. Make sure that you're sharing your stories and that you're listening to one another. Once again, I want to thank my wonderful team from DCP Entertainment for making this show possible. Y'all can follow me on Twitter at B. Van Dalen. And I want to thank today's special guests, Vice President Joe Biden, Minister Tobias Elwood, and Pam Swan. Please use hashtag InnerSpace on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. And please share your journey with us about emotional well-being.